If you listen to this podcast, you probably believe event-driven architectures are a good idea. But how do you design them and how do you document them? This stuff's all pretty new and those tools aren't all mature yet. Well, once and future streaming audio guest Bobby Calderwood is here to tell us about event modeling, a framework and toolset for such a time as this. Now, we've had a couple of episodes with some audio trouble recently. This is one of them. So please bear with us on today's episode of Streaming Audio, a podcast about Kafka, Confluent, and the cloud. Hello and welcome to another episode of Streaming Audio. I am your host, Tim Berglund, joined again as a returning guest by my friend, Bobby Calderwood. Bobby, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tim. Great to be on again.
Yeah, I really enjoyed our previous conversation. Something like a year ago, I didn't look it up and I don't remember these things precisely, but we talked about a lot of some of the financial systems you work on and the intersection of functional programming and event-driven architectures. Does that all sound like it was real?
Yeah, no, it sounds like a dream. It sounds like a far-off dream. Yeah,
we a dream, but a good dream.
That's right. No, that was one of my favorite things I did last year in my career. It was so fun to be on the podcast, and I always enjoy talking to you, you know, whether on the podcast or at conferences or whenever we meet up. So, yeah, no, it was great. Yeah, we talked about functional programming, functional microservices, and a lot of, I think, what we'll talk about today kind of extends and enriches that particular topic. So.
Yeah, hard to go wrong with those things. So you recently spoke at Kafka Summit. It's recent as of the time that we're recording this. Because that was not quite a month ago as of this recording. And you talked about event-driven information systems and particularly how to model them. And that's just so there's no suspense. That's what I want to talk about today. But I'd love an update. We talked about all this financial stuff. Are you able to talk about what you've been working on recently? But just before you do that, I sometimes cite you by name as one of the few people who's built more than one event-driven system. Like everybody's on their first right now.
Right.
Working, puzzling through all these hard problems and kind of learning this new discipline. I'm like, well, some people have done three. And, you know, so what are you working on right now?
Yeah. So I think we're midway through through good news, a good report on kind of the last podcast episode. We talked a lot about real-time payments, and the system we were working on at the time was this real-time payment system to help U.S. banks to plug into this really great new infrastructure that's available from the clearinghouse, the real-time payment system. We built that out. We were kind of in the market selling that to banks for quite a while. And just recently, we've started very serious talks about an acquisition where a business wants to acquire kind of the real-time payments part of our company. So the system that we built, all the IP around it, et cetera. So yeah, an acquisition, that's really, really great. So we're excited about that.
All kinds of not bad.
Yeah, no, it's really great. I can't talk about it in detail, obviously, because the negotiations are ongoing, but yeah, that's been a really exciting thing for our business. And I credit a lot of that success to the fact that it is event-driven and it is built on top of Kafka. You know, it's sort of this bulletproof infrastructure and architecture that's been really influential in our discussions and negotiations, both with the banks and with these other companies who have talked about acquiring us too. So.
Super. You said something in your talk about the way we think about event-driven systems. I think it's hard, and this is just based on my experience in the time I get to spend with architects and developers and folks who are trying to do this. And it seems like a lot of those actual sessions I've been in have been with financial companies. That's probably just a function of the fact that Kafka and event-driven architecture uptake is high among inside that vertical, but It seems like people have a hard time, right? It feels like we were taught at one point it was hard to build a system on top of a database and build a schema and all that. Like you had to learn that. Nobody is born being good at that, and we went through that process of learning it. And everybody who's been around for a little bit has built a few of those, and people who are new at it have learned and they're building their first one, and they kind of. There's this momentum behind that. And I feel like it's hard then to think about systems in terms of events. What do you think of that? Am I'm kind of questioning myself now, and maybe I'm identifying the wrong hard part, but what do you think?
No, I think that is really hard. And it's both hard to think about and hard to communicate about. And part of that is the issue that you brought up exactly, right? Part of it's engineer training, right? We were trained from brand new hatchling engineers to think about third normal form and the entity relationship diagram and the database and then sort of projecting that up a layer with a whole bunch of impedance mismatch into our code and thinking about the objects and their relationships and all that stuff. And that, look, it's an unnatural way of thinking, to your exact point. It took us a lot of training to think about things in that way. But, you know, to a man with a hammer, everything seems like a nail, right? Like, once you have that pattern and set of paradigms in your brain, that's the way that you sort of look at the world, and it becomes sort of a worldview, and it colors every problem that you approach, et cetera. So I think at this point, the difficulty for the engineering side of the organization is exactly what you said. It's, you know, when we're kids, we're used to thinking about things in terms of events. We think about them in narratives, like, hey, mom, I went outside and this happened and then this happened and that caused this other thing to happen, right? That's the story we tell our mom when we come back in from playing. So it's easy for us as humans to think about systems that, or to think about, you know, events that way. But then all this engineering training kind of gets in the way, and we were trained in a very unnatural way to think about problems in this very sort of silicon first sort of way, right? So I think for the engineers, that's what gets in the way is our training. On the other side of the house, you know, the business stakeholders and, you know, the potential users of our systems, the things that we build, I think we have trained them to think about these things wrong too. We train them to think about, you know, where is the data? How's it stored? What's the database? How do I query it? I think it's more natural for the business side of the house to think about things in terms of events and narratives. And okay, the customer comes and he asks or she asks us to do this, and then we think about it, and then we do this other thing instead, right? You know, so I think the business side of it still thinks in terms of events, but then when they start to think about the systems, they're like, oh, okay, now that event-driven thinking breaks down. It's not this explicit in their brains, but this is sort of the conversation they have with themselves is, I can think about it like a normal human up to this point, and now I've got to talk to the engineers, and now we've got to talk about it in terms of, you know, databases and the stuff that I sort of understand in a very fuzzy way, if at all, right? So that's, I think that's the issue. I think it's a self-inflicted wound on our part. I think we've done this to ourselves. Fortunately, I see light at the end of this tunnel. I think as we do start to sort of re-enshrine the business narrative as like the thing that we think about, and then systems we build, the business processes we build, et cetera, are subservient to that, right? They are built in the service of this business narrative. I think as we get back to that as an industry, it'll be a lot easier for new engineers to come on into the industry, right? They won't have to unlearn a whole bunch of bad thinking. They'll be building event-driven systems from the first day, and they'll be able to think about it in those terms. So that's kind of the thinking part of it, how we envision and talk to ourselves about these systems. The way we talk to other people about these systems is also really hampered by this, right? So there's this constant problem in software engineering. Agile tried to solve it, you know, user stories, jobs to be done, behavior-driven development. They're all efforts to solve this. How do we capture the requirements of the system? How do we describe the system to each other in a way that, you know, the regular humans can talk to the engineers, and the engineers can talk to each other and talk to the UI UX people and talk to the architects. And right, so like, how do we describe the system to ourselves during the design phase before any code's written? As we're writing code, how do we imagine that code to ourselves and describe it to each other? You know, this is the part of the system I'm working on today. And then when we're in operations, something goes wrong. There's an IT incident. How do we, you know, communicate that on the incident call? How do we talk about what went wrong on the incident call, you know, without having, you know, the proverbial Brent from Phoenix Project on that call? Do we have enough context and system understanding on the incident call to be able to address that incident, right? So throughout the software development lifecycle, there's this pervasive communication problem about how we envision these systems and how we describe them to each other. And there's no good solution, right? I mean, there's been tons of attempts throughout the years in industry to try to solve this problem, and it remains unsolved, right? I mean, user stories at some level are great sort of during the agile kind of planning and design process, but like they're not going to help you during an incident call, right? Like you're not going to bring up the user story in the incident call to try to like say, yeah, this part of the system's broken.
I'm sorry, but when you say it like that, Yeah, no, you're not ever going to do that.
No.
And stories are a good way of understanding some things. Just that's very funny. You're right.
Yes. Yes. So we lack this holistic system understanding and a holistic way of communicating about systems. And it's a problem. So
yeah, now I mean, in the 90s once I was involved in a big project that was written in C. That used structured analysis, structured design tools that could round trip. You build this particular, I'll say terrible kind of diagram, and it would generate code, and you fill in the functions with the good bits, and if you had to change method signature, or function signatures, or something like that, it would round trip and update the diagram. It's super space age, so you know there was a tool. For visualizing the system, for designing the system that attempted to stay up to date. But it's, you know what? No, I can't even, it's too much of a strongman question. I can't bring myself to ask, why doesn't that work? Because we all know that just doesn't
right.
work. that's actually it turned out to be a terrible idea. But you're right. We don't have a standard thing. Let's talk about some other options though. You mentioned user stories, and I don't want this to come off like we're bagging on user stories. They're a wonderful mechanism, but as you say, there are things they don't do. I think the agile answer to that is that you shouldn't want, or it's somehow a quest for an illegitimate thing to try to find something like a story that you can bring up in a support call. You know, it doesn't exist. The code is all that exists at that point.
Right.
Probably shouldn't debate that right now. we may agree anyway. But what else? I mean, like UML comes to mind. I think many people are thinking that right now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you bring up a good point with sort of the agile answer. There's in theology, there's sort of a parallel argument, right? Is it scripture or code only that is the source of truth, or is there scripture and tradition, which is code and tacit knowledge in the minds of the development team, right? Like, yeah, it's a big question, right? It's a sort of fundamental epistemological question that arises in software engineering, but it also arises in these other human domains of human endeavor. How much can we know? How do we know it? Are we sure we know it? Right. This is epistemology. That's the field of philosophy where we talk about these things. And it's a huge problem. it's one that has befuddled philosophers and theologians for many centuries. Right.
So I was going to say it's an enduring problem because there isn't an epistemological consensus. Right.
Right.
There isn't. You can't go ask philosophers and they'll all tell you the same answer of how we know things.
That's right. And I don't think we'll get there with code, especially not on a, 45 minute podcast either. So we're not going to solve this question.
I'm optimistic, but anyway, keep going.
But yeah, there have been these really great, and I certainly don't want to come off as denigrating any of these things we're talking about. Look, they're engineering tools. They all have features and they all have trade-offs, right? And I'll probably emphasize the trade-offs because I'm looking for a better way. But, the UML community, you sort of alluded to it earlier. Some really fantastic work. I mean, some almost magical engineering, to your point, like this ability to round trip from code to diagram, like that's magic, right? That's space age stuff. User stories, jobs to be done, behavior driven development with sort of given when then, Gherkin and phrasing and all that stuff, all super great attempts to solve this fundamental problem, this communication and knowability problem about how we collectively understand the complex thing. There are some drawbacks, right? So UML, I think, for the problem that I'm discussing, where you're trying to get this holistic system view across multiple skill sets, right? So you want your business stakeholders, even potentially your users, UI, UX folks, software architects, project managers, software engineers, you all want them on the same page, understanding the same things and knowing the same things. UML is not for that, right? UML is very focused at engineers. It's about specifically sort of object-oriented programming disciplines. There are parts of UML that are not specifically object-oriented, obviously, but a lot of it is sort of geared towards object-oriented code design, right down at the sort of code level. And it's really by engineers and for engineers. It's not about communicating how the system works to everybody else, right? Because you show a, sequence diagram or some of these other things, show that to other people and they're like, what, how does this help me make more money? Right. Like
it is a specialized form that you actually have to learn how to, not just how to create, but how to consume.
That's right. That's right. And at that point, you might as well be writing code, right? Because it's by engineers for engineers. It's only consumed by the engineers, right? Like at that point, like why not just be writing code? At some level, maybe it helps you visualize it because it sort of engages that visual cortex, that part of your brain that's super well developed. But look, you know, as an industry, I think we've mostly left UML behind. There's a few artifacts like sequence diagrams that sort of persist in kind of modern agile software practice, but a lot of that stuff has gone by the wayside. And, you know, to your point, kind of for good reason, right? It adds overhead to the engineering process without this sort of holistic communication benefit of being able to describe what we're doing to non-engineers. Then there's, you know, so that's kind of by engineer, for engineer type of diagramming and modeling disciplines. On the other side of the spectrum, there's sort of this this low-code world where it's like our IT department's a pain to work with, and so we're going to end run around them and empower this sort of legion of citizen coders to draw a picture and then press a button, and then that picture turns into a system. And all these things are sort of in these black box runtimes. And so, you know, from the IT department, it's sort of a double slap in the face, right? The IT department's like, okay, so you're end running around us. Cool. That feels really great. And then you're going to dump on into our laps this black box platform that doesn't fit any of the way that we do any of the rest of this stuff, right? It doesn't integrate with our CI/CD pipeline. It doesn't run on the same hardware, the same platforms. We don't know how to debug it. When something goes wrong in production, we don't have the same level of monitoring and instrumentation and stuff that we're used to with our regular, like real coding language things like the JVM or whatever we're running on. And so now, so it's sort of this double slap in the face, like, okay, A, you showed us that we're hard to work with and you'd rather just write the code yourself. Okay, great. And we have to operate this thing that is sort of a pain and doesn't fit with the rest of our IT world. So I think both of those fall short of this sort of whole system understanding and communication and bringing together kind of in that DevOps spirit, bringing together the different parts of the organization to work in harmony and build common understanding. I think the low code is a bit of a... it's a bit of a nuclear option, right? It's a bit of the, like, if you guys don't get on the same page with us, we're just going to forget about you and just go do low code. You know what I mean? It's more of an alternative than it is a thing that brings parts of the organization together, in my view and in my experience.
Right. Which I guess brings us to event modeling as you understand it. So you've got, I say you, this is a tradition I think that you're entering and also helping build. So by all means, talk about the landscape a little bit, but
yeah,
tell us about this emerging visual language and process.
Yeah, absolutely. So in my talk, I mentioned this a little bit. You know, on the one hand, kind of in the old days, we had this big design upfront moment where we're like spending a lot of time on the design. And then as we moved over to Agile, because, you know, a lot of those waterfall type processes didn't work, they postponed risk and, you know, all the things that we don't need to go into now about why sort of waterfall processes don't work for a lot of types of software engineering. As we swung over to Agile, we sort of threw out that design discipline in a lot of ways. We sort of went from like big design up front to like no design up front. And now we're just sort of like, oh, you know, the design will emerge as we test code refactor. Surely, you know, a design will emerge in our code. And I've never seen it happen, so I don't believe that story. You know, maybe within a single code base, you know, when you're talking about the how you structure your classes and function calls and method calls and stuff within a code base, maybe that can happen via TDD, but not a distributed systems, you know, design, not a like I say, sort of a holistic and well thought out way of solving business problems. That's not going to emerge from any particular code base test code refactor cycle, right? Like you have to have a design, right? And when software engineers code in the presence of a design, they're a lot more efficient and they're able to solve their problems a lot better. They spend a lot less time thrashing in the, I don't even know if I'm close to solving a problem because I don't know what problem I'm solving mode. Like early in my Agile software experience, you know, back in the late 2000s and in early 2010s, I spent a lot of time as a junior developer in that mode where it's like, I don't know what problem I'm solving. And so I can't really measure if I'm making progress. I'm doing stuff and I'm keeping busy and my head's down and I'm reporting stuff on stand up, but like, I don't know if I'm helping or if I'm hurting. So those are the two extremes, like the big design up front and the no design up front. I think both are really flawed. So in the search for this lightweight language that will allow us to do some design up front, but sort of just enough design up front and that serves us downstream of design in implementation and operations in the ways I described, getting everyone on board, getting the ops people and the business users and the stakeholders, kind of getting everyone speaking the same language. The best thing I've found in my career to this point is event modeling. Event modeling is a discipline that was invented, sort of pioneered by Adam Dimitrick, with help from Greg Young. Greg Young is sort of the coiner of the term event sourcing and CQRS. He sort of invented that at some level. Yeah, he's very, very good. In fact, I was just on a meetup with him a couple weeks ago where he gave his sort of original event sourcing talk. And it's sort of this talk that he's been giving for, you know, I don't know, 15 years, 12 years at least. And it's about a financial domain. So that kind of really spoke to me from my past experience. And he talks about why event sourcing is superior to thinking about current state. It's, you know, thinking about the events really helps you in a lot of these ways. So Greg and Adam, you know, work together. They're kind of up in the Seattle and Vancouver geography. And so they've been fellow travelers for a long time. And then Adam sort of distilled through his very extensive engineering experience, sort of distilled a lot of these thoughts around CQRS, event sourcing, how to do it in practice, what does it mean for coordinating with other teams and describing the system to your users, and how do you incorporate the user journey into this thing that is sort of back-endy, you know, in terms of event sourcing. So he distilled all this down to this really beautiful and very simple modeling language called event modeling. And it's super simple. And that's really the benefit of it, is it's high level enough and descriptive enough for non-technical skill sets to be able to engage and contribute meaningfully to the design and sort of system understanding. But it's also well specified enough to be immediately actionable by the software engineers. So it really is this sort of Goldilocks zone of just enough design, general enough for non-technical skill sets, but specific enough for software engineers, you know, whereas UML is much too specific and doesn't speak to this non-technical skill set. So it's this really, really great distillation. I got to give Adam a lot of credit for what he's built. So I discovered this while I was doing professional services work. You know, I was doing event storming, which is sort of a ancestor technique to event modeling. Alberto Brandolini did event storming. Some really good thought there as well, kind of from the DDD community. And I had come up with my own kind of hackneyed simplification of event storming that was more, you know, event storming tends to be very high level. Like, how do you map out kind of a whole domain?
We're really trying to explore a domain and generate shared understanding about.
That's right. That's right. And it's sort of about event storming explicitly is sort of about exploring the problem space. Like, hey, what's the problem we're trying to solve? How do we all work together to solve that problem? And it's much less about the solution space. Whereas event modeling is really truly solution oriented. Like, we're speccing out a piece of software we're going to build, you know, when you're approaching event modeling rather than exploring a business domain. And so I had come up with my own kind of hackneyed simplification to event storming. I called it low level, or, you know, whatever. I don't know. It was a terrible name, but low level event storming. And we were doing that, you know, when I was at Capital One, when I was at, you know, as soon as I started Evidence Systems and doing my professional services work with a bunch of big companies doing this, that's what we were working on. And in fact, actually, two colleagues of mine and I at Capital One were sort of given the job of coming up with the microservices curriculum there. And we incorporated event storming as sort of an explicit part of the 2-day training that we developed. We developed the curriculum and talked about all that. So event storming I've been doing for years. So, you know, since 2016 timeframe. And it was great and really liked that. As I found event modeling, I was like, yes, this is what I've been looking for. This is the kind of simplification, the lower level kind of zoom in and start talking about a specific system kind of focus that event storming didn't give me. So it's great. And so I've been doing it ever since, you know, kind of 2017, 2018 timeframe. Yeah.
Nice. Nice. You got a little bit of it under your belt at this point. I want to revisit just because you're making me think things, and not because this is the time to debate it, but the question of agile architecture. You have a settled opinion that it is substantially not a thing. And I know there are people who say that it is, and I don't even know if this podcast is the place to work that out. I might go and invite some people on to just talk about that because it's interesting and it kind of relates to this.
Yeah, I'd love to be involved in that conversation. I think it's a It's an important one. Just, you know, anecdotally and personally, I've met software architects or enterprise architects at companies that adopt Agile, and they feel homeless. They feel disempowered and disenfranchised at some level, where they're like, I used to know what my job was, and I drew pictures, and I thought about, you know, latencies and SLAs, and you know, that's what I used to do. And now in this Agile world, like, I don't know what I do. I serve as sort of a consulting developer on teams, and I sort of visit three or four teams and help them with hard things, but that doesn't feel architect-y to me. That sort of feels, you know, engineer SWAT team to me, right? So I've seen a lot of architects struggle with this. So I think it's an open question. I don't think we've solved it all the way.
We haven't. And I'm just imagining the Agile architecture proponent answering what you just said with good.
Yeah, right. And that's fine. Well, if that's your answer, that's fine. But look, there's a real human cost there, right? I mean, you've got these people who have been doing a job for a lot of years, and like, they have a ton of wealth of experience and depth, and they understand, like, they know where all the skeletons are buried in these systems, and to disenfranchise them and lose them, you're losing a lot. There's a real human cost there.
Yeah. Yeah. And a cost to the organization. I mean, human
yeah,
cost
absolutely.
Is one thing, but
yeah,
you know, there were once a lot of blacksmiths and there are fewer of them now. Sometimes that happens.
Right.
And there's a human cost, and like, somebody's got to love those people, but in economic transitions like this, and one could argue that it is such a time for the enterprise architect, but maybe not. It's very much an open question. That would be an interesting panel to do. So for the future, if you're listening, at me if you think that sounds a good idea. And where else did I want to go with that? We're talking about architecture and so the other insight I had has to do with a book I'm reading right now called The Fifth Discipline by Peter Senge. It's a systems thinking, it's really a management book, I think, but a super intellectually interesting one. The subtitle is The Art and Practice of the Learning Organization. It's originally, I think, written like 30 years ago, but updated maybe 15 years ago. So some of the examples feel, you know, like I'm young again. But the ideas are kind of blowing my mind, and the whole, you know, architecture emerging thing, and on what scale does architecture emerge? And you made the point here and in your talk, when you've got multiple systems that are interacting, it doesn't seem like the Agile architecture thing really happens then. Maybe if there's one system, there's like enough mental state that implicitly or otherwise people have the structure of the thing in their minds and they're able to reason about it. But then there are these, you're building a composite system out of individual subsystems that have fairly primitive interfaces. And all you really know is that primitive interface, but not enough of the structure and interaction of the other system. And if you never know enough about the structure and interaction of the other system, then it's maybe impossible on principle for that architecture to emerge.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, there's a lot of really great writing and thinking about, you know, dynamics of complex systems, et cetera. I really love the DevOps community for embracing and really, you know, John Allspaugh and some of those other folks that look at complex systems and complex system failure specifically. And they're like, look, when a complex system fails, you can't just fire the person who was the proximate cause because it is not their fault. Right. Like if you look at the dynamic, right. Yeah. Right. There may not be such a thing as fault, but you know, complex systems are, you know, definitionally like complex. There's a lot of different concerns and they are twisted and intertwined with each other in ways that make it impossible to predict. That's the definition of a complex system, is you cannot predict the outputs of the system from the inputs, right? That's how we define a complex system. And, you know, yeah, so to that point, it is unethical to fire someone because they put in the wrong inputs and got an output you don't like, because that's
I'm even kind of coming to the conclusion that it's a little sketchy to say root cause. I kind of don't
like
those words anymore.
Right. You know, the five whys analysis and all that works at some level, but not in an absolute sense when you're dealing with complex systems.
Yeah.
The real trick to this is, you know, look, and this is the trick for political science and political economy too, right? Where you've got this infinite possibility, you know, all of these economic agents interacting with each other. And a lot of the times that turns out really well. And you know, capitalism, trade, and markets, like I'm a huge proponent of those things, you know, for good reason. I think we've seen historically that those things work really well. and they work better than a planned economy. So there's this real tension in these complex systems between teleology, which is like, I have a goal and I want to get to that goal. So that's kind of teleology. We're doing a lot of philosophy on this podcast, Tim.
We are. I like that. Yeah, teleology is so teleology. Orientation towards a purpose.
Yes, there's orientation towards a purpose.
There's an end or a goal.
Yeah. That's right. So, you know, beginning with the end in mind, or, you know, there's a lot of management thinkers that talk about that. So teleology on the one side, and I put kind of UML and a lot of these big design up front kind of waterfall things in that teleology first camp. Teleology is being the most important thing. We want to know where we're going. And then there's sort of the emergent, you know, hey, good things happen when you release the constraints in a system and allow the agents in that system to interact with each other however they choose. A lot of times those systems will come to a steady state that is superior to anything you could have arrived at teleology. So like a planned economy is teleological, a market economy is emergent. And again, historically, I mean, we don't want to turn this into political show, but like, but historically we've seen that markets are superior in many ways to planned economies because the unforeseen steady states that a market economy can achieve outperform the narrow sort of planned goal that I had for this planned economy. There's a real similar dynamic in software where there's this real tension between where I want to go and if I have too many constraints in the pursuit of that goal, I eliminate the possibility of these really good steady states that I couldn't have envisioned beforehand, but that would be a much better place for my company to be than the goal that I set at the beginning, right? So it's this real, again, epistemology, teleology, like it's this real thorny question. You don't want to lock down that process too much. And I think that's why a lot of people from the Agile community would say, good, get rid of those enterprise architects. Those guys were really cramping our style, right? They're harsh on our mellow. They put all these constraints on us. And as a result, we couldn't do our best work. And that's fair. I think there's an absolute truth to that at some level. Like when you put constraints on a system, especially if you put the wrong constraints on a system, you end up tamping down a lot of those hypothetical potential good steady states that emergent system could obtain and achieve. On the other hand, if you have no rules of the road, if you have this sort of pure laissez-faire, like let everyone do what they want thing, like you could end up at a sort of a local optimum, but vastly miss sort of the global optimum. So you've got to figure out a way to sort of set the right rules of the road, set just enough constraint and just enough rules to promote the incentive structures and the emergent states that you want and eliminate some of the emergent states you don't want or that would be very suboptimal. And you know, that's the role of regulation in the economy. But doing that well is a dark art, right? There's no scientific way necessarily to sort of think about these things and pick among the outcomes of this complex system that you want and eliminate all the bad ones, right? You can't really do that because, again, the nature of complex systems. Yeah, but you know, you can set reasonable rules of the road that are based on values, that are based on principles, right? Not a tactical, like do this, do that, you know, kind of mechanical set of constraints, but rather a set of constraints that are around values and around principles and around, you know, kind of these broad ideas that will guide us to the right set of emergent states in this complex system. So that's what I think, you know, we got like real deep there for a second, bringing it all the way back to event modeling. I think that's what we have here with event modeling is this sort of, let's just set a couple of rules of the road. Let's put the business process and the business events and the narrative, let's make that the central thing, right? Not the needs of the silicon or the training of the engineers, but the business process, let's make that the center concern. Okay, that's kind of principle one of event modeling. So we talk about, when we do event modeling, we talk about the events first. So in event modeling, there's kind of these four visual words. There's commands, events, read models, and interfaces or wireframes. And that's it, right? There's just these four words, and there's a set of sort of structured data flows among these kind of components, so it makes this sort of graph. And the first thing you do in the practice of event modeling is just get the events up there. So they're represented by these orange sticky notes, and you get them up and sequence them into kind of a plausible narrative, and you say, okay, these are the major business outcomes that we need to record in order to understand what's going on here. So we talk about how to record those things in terms of events. And then the other sort of principle or guiding value in event modeling is let's Let's talk about the user's experience. Let's think about their flow. Let's think about, you know, kind of what they experience. So the next thing we do in our MET modeling practice is we talk about the wireframes. So we wireframe out the system. It's, you know, similar in principle to journey mapping, user journey mapping, or customer journey mapping. But you think about what the user is experiencing. Okay, at this, you know, rough part of the chronology here, you know, the timeline's running from left to right along the bottom. At this point in the event chronology, what is the user seeing or experiencing or doing? And we sort of map that out. So those are two of the big values. Like, let's think about the business narrative and let's think about the user's experience. Those are the two big values that set the rules of the road for event modeling. It set the sort of the basic structure for event modeling. And then in order to get well specified and be able to talk about specific software components we need to build, then we talk about commands and read models. So commands are how users introduce change into the system. It's, you know, do this for me, please. You know, the user clicks a button in the wireframe that sends a command to the system saying, hey, please do this for me. Place my order. Sign up for my account. Transfer money from one account to another. That's a command. And then that command, we think about it and we process it and we reason about invariance and say, I don't know, do we have an account with this customer? Does the customer have an account with us? Do they have enough money in their account to cover this transfer? You know, we assert all the invariance there when we're sort of processing this command. And as a result of that command, we either return back to the interface like, nope, sorry, not going to do that. Or we write out an event. We say, yep, money transferred. That event has happened. We're going to write it down. And then, so that empowers our users. We empower our users by putting the commands on the board so that they can make a change. And then we inform our users via the read models. So as those events are happening, we aggregate those events up using technologies like Kafka and Kafka Streams, especially, or KSQL.
Maybe some kind of stream processor. Like,
yeah, some sort of stream processing thing that can observe events going by and aggregate them or take action on them.
Yep. Efficient key lookups to certain aggregates. Sure.
That's right. Yeah.
So something like that.
Yeah, one might need such a thing. So you build this read model in order to answer your user's questions about the state of the system. So I place my order, and then I go check on the status of my order. You know, the read model is what informs me about, has my order shipped? And has my, you know, is this order the right one? And, you know, all those questions that users may have. So we empower, we inform our users. Those are the other kind of values that shape this. So we're focused on the business narrative. We're focused on the user's experience. We empower our users. We inform our users. And then we also need to integrate with the outside world because our system doesn't exist in a vacuum. So we need to be able to export or import state from other systems. So there's a pattern in event modeling for external state import where we listen to the events of some foreign system and then incorporate those events into our own narratives and then take some action on that. So that's all about kind of listening to some foreign stream. Again, Kafka Streams and other related stream processing technologies are great for this because that upstream system doesn't even need to know that I care. They don't even need to know about me. They're just doing their thing, going about their work the way that they're supposed to and generating events as a result. And then I can subscribe to those events and import their state into my world and inform what's going on in my system. So that's external state import.
That can be some terrible thing. You're scraping a file or something, like you're doing CDC on a table, whatever. It's the mechanics of the integration happen and you turn that into events. And there's a sense in which you have to maybe make sense of that external systems event in terms of the context of your system, right?
That's right. So we call that translation. Adam calls that translation in his world. So if you're getting low level events, so his canonical example is like a geo events. So, you know, your phone is just slinging off these geo coordinate events because, you know, it's kind of creepy and it's tracking you everywhere you go, but it's throwing off these geo cords. But those geo cords by themselves don't mean anything to your application necessarily. So you have to translate those, you know, raw geo events via some sort of business logic to contextualize them and make them relevant to your application. So oftentimes that's something like geo fencing where you say, hey, when the customer enters my store or when the customer enters the hotel, that's a business event. So I'm translating these raw events via this piece of logic, a geofencing piece of logic, and then I emit this more contextual event to my kind of local event topic saying, like, hey, customer showed up at the hotel. We should do something as a result of that. Or maybe we just record it and figure out what to do about it later. But that's an important thing in our domain. So yeah, exactly. There's sort of this translation process. And then the last pattern that goes with this value of we don't exist in a vacuum and we need to integrate with other systems is internal state export. I always mess that up. Internal state export, where we've got stuff going on in our world. We can't just rely on someone else to listen to us and do the right thing. We need to go out and issue a command into some foreign system, right? So a lot of times this is like payment processors. That's kind of Adam's canonical example of this. You know, things are happening, users checking out and doing all their stuff in our application. And then we've got to go talk to that dreaded payment gateway. And it's a foreign system and we don't control it. And we don't even know if it's event oriented or not. Like, we just need to go cause some change in that system. So right now I use Stripe in my application that I'm building right now, which we'll talk about in a minute. And that's how we treat Stripe exactly. We have stuff going on in our application. We reach out and talk to Stripe. Stripe is fantastic, and they do have an event-oriented interface, which is their webhooks. And then they basically call us back and say, yep, thing happened, or, oh, whoops, there was an error, a bad thing happened. But we get an event back as a result of that. If you don't have an event-oriented foreign system, you just sort of call that command or web service or whatever, and then the result of that web service's call will include a lot of information about whether it succeeded or failed. And then you write that down as an event locally as well. So we're still always thinking in terms of events, even when we're dealing with foreign systems. Sometimes we have to generate those events ourselves as a result of the web services call, you know, whatever the result of taking that action was. But for good foreign systems like Stripe, we can call them and count on the fact that they're gonna sling an event back to us asynchronously.
Good external systems, foreign systems that do some sort of financial transaction in an event-driven way. I don't know if you know anything about that, but I know a guy I could introduce you to who could tell you all about it. Just if you're listening and didn't pick up on that, that guy's Bobby. He's like the guy who knows everything about that. So anyway, I imagine in the external state import and internal state export pieces, I mean, those get reduced to code at some point. When you're interfacing with things that are not so well behaved, meaning things which are synchronous, that's where you get those little impedance matching transformers doing polling or keeping tables of things and doing the adapting from the internals of the event-driven system to the unfortunate synchronous externals of the world.
And look, that's a reality, and, you know, any solution which has to be big bang and you have to apply it all at once across every piece of your organization and rewrite every piece of code you've ever had, it's never going to work, right? That's not a viable strategy. So yeah, event modeling acknowledges sort of the realities of that. And in the internal state export pattern, Adam explicitly talks about, you know, you've got these events going by, you actually build a read model solely for the purpose. This, the read model is not for informing your users necessarily. This read model is just kind of the to-do list of work that you need to do against some foreign system. And you may be able to do that piecewise, you know, each event that flows through, you do your side effect and then you record the result of that side effect. But look, sometimes you've got to batch those things up and send them once a day as a file, or, you know, it's some ugly thing, right? But building that read model is sort of a key part of that internal state export pattern, because having that read model allows you to reason about the SLA and reason about, you know, are we doing this in terms of single piece flow each event, or are we batching them up and sending them in micro batches? Are we doing a big file at the end of the day and we're reconciling some external ledger or something. These patterns are sort of sufficiently flexible in general that allows you to do a lot of things at the implementation level, which satisfy the design, but, you know, are ugly and dirty, and you've got to sort of hack around the fact that you're dealing with some system that doesn't deal with this very well. Adam has a whole article about event modeling for legacy systems or event modeling for existing systems, where he talks about, you know, you can take an existing system and then start to sort of, you know, model it out what it does today, and then start to sort of change and evolve that model and slice off, you know, features from that core system and start doing it yourself and building these little event-driven slices of the event model outside of that foreign system while still relying on that legacy system to kind of do the bulk of the work or some part of the work that is regulated or, you know, whatever you need it to do.
So it's refactoring to events via event modeling.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice. And as you say, that's sounds like when it comes time to actually put this into practice, a critical discipline, because you're usually not greenfield. Sometimes you are, save for those times, but there's probably something else in the world you have to talk to.
That's right.
It's probably not event driven.
Yeah. Sadly, not yet. Right. In that future day that we talked to at the beginning of the show, like when engineers are coming out of school and the first system they work on is an event-driven system, and that's the only way they know, at that future date, you won't have to worry about those things quite as much.
That's right. And we'll be old men and talking about how we started with ERDs back in the day. And the kids will say, right. What's an ERD? Let me tell you.
Oh, back in my day.
Now, there's, I guess, a couple of things, and we're coming up against time, which is, I think, one of the challenges is that it's interesting to talk to you about things. And so we just kind of do that. So, but there's the actual process. You gave us the visual language, and then there is, you said this almost was born as a souped-up version of event storming. And event storming, if you don't know, is a thing a group of people does together. So
yeah,
there's the
workshop.
Process.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a workshoppy process of doing this.
Yep.
And then there's the visual artifact. But I think, if I may, and I just want to flag, yes, of course, there is a way that you do this. And we'll link to resources if you want to check out more about that. But I'd love to hear about where you've done this. You know, what successes can you talk about that you've put this in practice?
Yeah. So the one I allude to and refer to over and over again in my Kafka Summit talk is with a big tax preparation service. We're doing helping them re-envision and re-engineer and redesign their tax platform, kind of the core piece of their business. And we did event modeling with them, really successful. Got all the kind of business folks in the room with the engineers, and you know, just from a communication and context sharing perspective, the workshop itself was a huge success. It was great. The artifact that comes out of it, you know, we've got a big piece of butcher paper covered in sticky notes, leaves something to be desired, which is why we ended up building our own sort of modeling platform, which we'll talk about in a second. But the artifact left something to be desired. We did, you know, end up digitizing that artifact in like Visio and then, you know, making stories out of it and building to those stories. But that process at the end was really hard. But the actual workshop moment itself was great. We also did one with a pharmaceutical research company. They try to find new drugs and treatments for genetic and other types of disorders via this big data processing pipeline. Super, super cool company. Just raised a bunch of money. They're really doing well. We went and did a workshop with them to do exactly this, you know, kind of map out their domain. And part of the day was sort of this high level, more event storming-y kind of exercise. And then part of it, we sort of got down to brass tacks on a particular piece of the system and then talked through, okay, how would we build this piece and what would it look like and what would the user see? And we did that via event modeling. So both really successful workshops, really love that. In my own software engineering for building our products internally at Evidence Systems, so that was all professional services stuff. But on the product side of Evidence Systems, we also use event modeling. So for our real-time payments system, for our event modeling product itself, we do event modeling, which is like super meta and cool. But like we actually build event modeling to talk about how to build event modeling in our event modeling platform. So we do all of that kind of stuff. We eat our own dog food with the product itself to do those things.
And you're building that tool. So tell us about that tool.
Yeah. So as I said, sort of getting to the end of an event modeling workshop, you know, and having seeing a bunch of people try to take like the panoramic mobile shot, mobile photo of the big piece of butcher paper covered in sticky notes. Look at least something.
And then turn it into Visio. So it's
yeah, that's right. And then you know, it's two or three BAs, you know, for 3 days, like just trying to digitize this thing, and you know, squinting and looking at other people's handwriting through this blurry, you know, panoramic shot. It's not great, right? It leaves something to be desired. Event storming was sort of meant to be explicitly be a co-located workshop experience. When Adam designed event modeling, it was a little looser. He's like, no, this can be done effectively remotely. This can be done effectively with everyone sitting on their own computer, you know, kind of in some sort of collaborative environment, building this event model. So our experience with some of these successes that we talked about, and understanding that part of the philosophy from Adam, that this doesn't have to be an in-person workshop, but this can be a thing that evolves over time asynchronously as well. We built our own event modeling platform called Onote. So Onote, onote.com. It's free. You can sign up for it. Please go do. it's great. We love it. It was something that we built just to scratch our own itch and to help, you know, the event modeling community. But as we got into it and started building it, we're like, this has huge potential, right? So a lot of folks were using kind of collaborative whiteboards for doing these event models. And those are great. They're great sort of general purpose tools. But Onote is a more constrained modeling environment. So you can't end up with an invalid event model, right? You can only draw arrows from things that make sense to other things that make sense, right? You can't make invalid connections.
It enforces the semantics of
it. Yeah, it enforces the semantics. You know, the actual structure in terms of the visuals, the vertical space on the modeling canvas is constrained so that only valid, you know, only events can go down in the bottom section and only wireframes can go in that top section and only commands and read models can go in this kind of center spinal column section. And anyway, so we constrain the modeling canvas, but then, you know, behind the scenes of that, we've got sort of the visual projection of the event model, like the visual piece of it. But behind the scenes, we're building this data structure, right? It's just a data structure that we have in memory, and then we store it to disk locally in your browser. And using this data structure, we can do all kinds of really cool stuff, right? So we can, so as you move from the design phase, where we can do sort of that collaborative design where we're all working on Onote together, collaboration is a feature we're going to release very soon within the next couple of weeks, probably before this podcast episode drops, we will have a collaborative environment. But then as you transition from the design kind of workshop moment into this implementation phase, we can generate code. So we can actually generate based on the commands and read models and the schemas you associate with those things. We can generate GraphQL, gRPC, OpenAPI Swagger, maybe even async API. We're looking at that as well. So we can generate kind of the interface definition code. And then you can take that specification and use it in your tool chain of choice, you know, if it's Java or JavaScript or Go or whatever. There's already existing tool chains for ingesting that interface definition level, interface definition language artifact and getting to runtime code. We can integrate with like Confluent Cloud. That's one of our targets is, you know, being able to say, hey, we've got all these lanes of events here. We can just create a topic for each lane and then we can put the schemas that we define in the event model into the schema registry in Confluent Cloud. So there's a lot of sort of integration level stuff we can do to speed the implementation process along. Another cool one there is rather than having the sort of separate user story generation exercise or sort of process that you do in Agile, a ritual sometimes they call it, we can actually just carve up this diagram into the set of tasks that are required to implement this diagram. Adam calls those slices. They're kind of these vertical slices of functionality that have a well-defined contract. They have well-defined inputs, well-defined outputs, and that represents sort of a discrete unit of developer or engineering work. And so rather than having a separate user stories exercise during your Agile planning, we can carve this diagram up, dump it into Jira for you. As you burn those tasks down in Jira or whatever, GitHub issues or wherever you track your work, as you burn those things down, we can show like in an overlay or something on top of your diagram, here's the progress you've made on this, right? So you can we can start to really integrate with the design process, the implementation process, and then during operations, as I said, we can integrate with your data platform, and pull out some metrics and monitoring, and actually maybe start to visualize the data flow through your system in real time. You can start to see like people are stuck at this part of our checkout flow, and we can see that on the metrics visually and all that stuff. So there's a lot we can do with this event model that's not just about design. It's valuable from the design through the implementation into operations. You know, again, another one is like IT incident management, right? Something bad has happened. Our system's broken. The people who built the system aren't necessarily on the call, so we're missing a lot of that mental context. Can we use this artifact, this design artifact, to reason about where the system's broken, to visualize the metrics and see what's happening, and then fix this system without needing the original team that has all that shared tribal knowledge in their heads? So. Anyway, a lot of really exciting things on our roadmap. Right now, Onote is sort of just the modeling canvas piece of it, but we have a roadmap that gets it, you know, a lot farther along and becomes sort of an integral part of accelerating the software engineering process and helps you to adhere to these broad rules of the road that we sort of outlined earlier, that if all the systems in your enterprise are just sort of following these basic rules of generating events and informing their users, empowering their users, you know, caring about their journey and having structured ways of integrating with other systems. If everyone's following those rules, you don't need, you know, real strict architecture from the outside. Those rules are enough to where you end up with this really great emergent type of thing where people are able to use these data and build extensions and really cool alternative views of these data without having to be so teleological about it, right? You can be emergent, you can be iterative, and everyone kind of doing the right thing, and you get to this really cool steady state emergent world, the ecosystem. But you do have these broad rules of the road, so you don't just end up with this senseless chaos, right? You've solved a lot of the hard distributed system problems. You've solved a lot of the consistency and all of those difficult things just by adhering to the rules baked into event modeling.
My guest today has been Bobby Calderwood. Bobby, thanks for being a part of Streaming Audio.
Thank you.
Hey, you know what you get for listening to the end? Some free Confluent Cloud. Use the promo code 60PDCAST. That's 60PDCAST to get an additional $60 of free Confluent Cloud usage. Be sure to activate it by December 31st, 2021, and use it within 90 days after activation. And any unused promo value on the expiration date will be forfeit, and there are a limited number of codes available, so don't miss out. Anyway, as always, I hope this podcast was helpful to you. If you want to discuss it or ask a question, you can always reach out to me at TL Berglund on Twitter. That's TLBERGLUND. Or you can leave a comment on a YouTube video or reach out in our community Slack. There's a Slack signup link in the show notes if you'd like to join. And while you're at it, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and to this podcast wherever fine podcasts are sold. And if you subscribe through Apple Podcasts, be sure to leave us a review there. That helps other people discover us, which we think is a good thing. So, thanks for your support, and we'll see you next time.